Elliot walks past the ping pong table. When he hears more noises in the backyard, again he calls out the name, Harvey. This generates tension and suspense in the audience. With the pizza box in hand, Elliot walks past the patio table and towards the shed in the backyard. A bright crescent moon hangs in the night sky. This adds enchantment to the scene. There is a mist in the air. A bright light shines in the shed. Elliot places the pizza box on the ground as he approaches the shed. He is still carrying the baseball and glove as he stands in the front of the shed. He tosses the ball into the shed. After a few seconds, the ball is tossed back out to him and hits him in the foot. This is the payoff to the setup of the baseball prop. This event surprises both Elliot and the audience. Elliot becomes frightened, turns and steps on the pizza box as he runs towards the house. This is the inciting event in Elliot's story. There is some creature hiding in the shed that will change his whole life. A few years ago, friends and family lovingly told me they were worried about my health. But the fact is, I was worried about my health. I was 280 pounds and tired. Getting healthy to that point in my life had not worked very well. I couldn't maintain a diet, and I kept saying I was going to exercise, but the pain that came with moving overrode the desire to better my life. This time, another friend asked if I wanted to work with him in losing weight. I said yes. That changed my life. It's not because I subscribe to some specific ideal of body shape, but the cholesterol and blood pressure meds had frustrating side effects. And though they did their job, they kept me from things. Early on in my journey, I would start walking through my neighborhood. It was easy. All I had to do was walk out my front door. I didn't have to drive. I didn't need any gear. All I needed was my Walkman and my Garth Brooks tape. I think The Hits by Garth Brooks was the perfect soundtrack to my walk. I still walk that neighborhood and take a turn into the cemetery. Cemeteries are great places to walk. There isn't much traffic. There's something to read with every step. They're quiet, and they serve as a reminder. I wrote down many thoughts in those days, and I wrote this thing concerning that cemetery. As I walk through the gate, I hear the chorus, "I'm much too young to feel this damn old." I can't help but chuckle. I'm walking through the cemetery, and I feel old. As I walk through the small road and look at the old and new graves, I am forced to keep my mortality in perspective. Someday my body will be laid cold, then heated up shortly when I'm cremated. And what is left is the knowledge I pass down. The cemetery reminds me why I work and the purpose of my work. Even now, I love to walk among the gravestones. I remember shortly after moving to Jackson to be with my wife, and after I'd left my last hospice chaplain job, I had a hard time finding work. And I worked with this landscaping company. And that landscaping company cut that cemetery years before I used it just for gentle walks. Cutting the lawn of a cemetery could be stressful. First off, sometimes the mower gets out of hand, and tombstones are much easier to knock over than you'd think. But then there's the grass that grows around the edges of the stones. We had to weed eat around every stone in the cemetery. And I didn't seem to ever do this quickly enough. They were always on me to go faster. Then I would run out of weed eater string. Well, I wouldn't actually run out per se. I would have to initiate the automatic string release to get more string by popping the weed eater on something solid, which made me wonder, with nothing else around, is it disrespectful to pop the weed eater head on a tombstone? I wrestled with this. It wasn't like I could walk back to the road every time I needed more string, because if you've ever used a weed eater, you know that if you use it against a solid object, the string burns through much quicker. What I decided was that I wouldn't pop the weed eater head on stones that were currently being looked at. But that still made me nervous. And I thought, if I get buried here, I want my tombstone to say, go ahead and pop your weed eater here. And it occurred to me that reading tombstones can be fun. I read one the other day that said, burns in our hearts forever. Because I knew that's why I keep antacids around. Another one quoted this passage from Job. Naked I came into the world, and naked I go out. And I wonder if the funeral was awkward or an open casket. Then realized, at least if it was a man, it's good they split the difference between the upper and the lower door on the casket. Sometimes I walk through the cemetery and I think of all the funny things I could put on gravestones. And I'm a little sad I plan on getting cremated. But I do have a point to all this. Elliot's mother sits at the table with a dog. Harvey, he's at her side. Elliot, Michael, and Gertie appear to be eating supper. This is a home without a father, which creates more empathy for the protagonist. Gertie asks Elliot what he's going to be for Halloween. He's depressed and replies that he's not going. Mike mocks him by suggesting that he go as a goblin. Elliot snaps back, telling Mike to shut up. The mother tries to explain that it's not that they don't believe him, but Elliot cries out that the creature was real. The audience also knows the creature is real. This generates more empathy for the protagonist. Mike offers the suggestion, perhaps it was an iguana, or a deformed child, or maybe an elf, or a leprechaun. Elliot gets angry. It was nothing like that. Expletive deleted. Breath. Mary, his mother, shouts at him to sit down. Elliot responds with, Dad would believe me. Mary replies, maybe you ought to call your father and talk to him about it. I can't. He's in Mexico with Sally, said Elliot. Both Mary and Mike are upset, while Gertie asks, where's Mexico? Mary excuses herself and leaves the table. She walks to the window as Mike tells Elliot that he's going to kill him. If you ever see it again, don't touch it. Just call me and we'll call someone to come take it away, says Mary. Like the dog catcher? Asks Gertie. But they'll give it a lobotomy or do experiments on it or something. This sets up the audience's expectation about the harm that will befall the alien when it's captured. After a bit of dialogue concerning who should be doing the dishes, Mary leaves the room saying, he hates Mexico. The scene explores the emotional relationship between the family members in greater detail. Empathy is also generated for Mary, who was abandoned by her husband. She is left with the responsibility of raising the children while he's traveling with his girlfriend in Mexico, a country which he hates. Elliot takes some dishes to the sink, turns on the faucet, and gazes out the window as water steams up from the sink. Steven Spielberg said that he wanted his childhood to resemble the image of a Norman Rockwell painting. His sister said he wanted his family to be like Father Knows Best. And until he was 19, he could pretend like it was. But we all know that the surface doesn't always match what's beneath. Steven was bullied as a kid. His father was gone and often working, and he would retreat to himself. His mother, he says, was more like a sister. She was like Peter Pan. It was when he was 16 that his father gave him a camera and he began to understand this dream that he would have the rest of his life. Spielberg said, "The camera was my pen. I wrote my stories through the lens when I was able to say action and cut. I wrested control of my life." At 19, his parents divorced when his mother pursued a relationship with one of his father's best friends. "Of this," he said, "it's still a mystery to me. But even though my mother was like an older sister to me, I kind of put her on a pedestal," Spielberg said. "And my dad was much more terrestrial, much more grounded, and much more salt of the earth. And for this reason, it was easier for me to blame him than it was to someone who I was already exalted." The movie E.T., which I've been reading from the script, The Extraterrestrial, was initially going to be a movie without an extraterrestrial in it. He wanted to make a movie about a child coping with a parent's divorce. I must admit, I didn't really remember much about E.T. I remembered E.T. I remembered a glowing finger in the scene where Elliot flies past the moon, but that's about it. I never noticed as a child how dark and meaty this movie really was. In more than one scene, Mary, the mother, is working hard to simply hold it together for her children. In fact, in the entire movie, the line that stuck out to me the most was from Gertie, Drew Barrymore's character, who says, "Where's Mexico?" As Mary walked away crying, she said, "He hates Mexico." As I watched E.T. this past week, I'd never really noticed the lighting. The movie contrasts light and dark in every scene, forcing our eyes to the negative space. The light is always shining on something or someone. It's this way in the beginning when Elliot first sees E.T. It happens when they play together while he's pretending to be sick and skipping school. And who can forget the shot of Elliot's bike racing past the moon, a shadow on the lit face? Later on, a similar scene goes on with the setting sun. But this time, not just Elliot, but the entire gang of boys, while Mary and Gertie and whatever the doctor's name is, follow along in the car. The boys fly past a setting sun, signaling not only success, but resolution, letting us know that relationships must always change. All throughout the movie, Spielberg uses the light to draw the two together. In some ways, I think it symbolizes their connection. Because E.T. must be connected. He doesn't understand life without connection. His people were always connected. In the movie, their hearts glow when they talk to one another. In the movie, there's almost a telepathic connection between them. He dies in this movie from the separation of his people. And he was brought back to life after first letting Elliot go, then knowing that his friends had not only responded when he phoned home, but that they were on their way. "Come," says E.T. "Stay," says Elliot. The two characters had merged into one protagonist. They must now split apart because now they have different primary objectives. E.T. wants to return home and Elliot wants to remain. E.T. lifts his finger to his lips and says, "Ouch." Of course, this indicates the pain he feels of their separation. Elliot tearfully lifts his finger to his lips and says, "Ouch." The symmetry of his movements indicate that in some sense, they are still one. E.T. and Elliot hug each other as they are visually surrounded by blue and white lights. Then Elliot and Mary exchange glances as Mike and Gertie stand by and watch E.T. watch E.T. lift his finger to Elliot's forehead. It lights up and he says, "I'll be right here." The resolution of the dilemma through E.T. leaves. Though E.T. leaves, he will still remain, perhaps telepathically or perhaps only within Elliot's thoughts. "Bye," Elliot says. I was never a great dancer, but I was good. I was strong enough to lead with the Lindy Hop that I could lead most people who at least knew the steps. As long as they were doing the same dance as me, I could lead. And I learned that life was like dancing, that I had to be different things at different times. I led a strong follow differently than I led a weak follow. I danced differently in different situations, but the dancer is always me. Garth Brooks. Seems like when I was in high school, everyone was singing the dance. We would learn it in sign language. It transcended music style prejudices that were so common in my day. Because Garth Brooks was arguably one of the best country musicians of all times. And he sang to us, "Yes, my life is better left to chance. I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the dance." Spielberg's movies always involved the underdog, because growing up, he felt like the underdog. "He always stayed busy," he says. "When I had too much time to think, all of those scary whispers would start up. It was not fun to be me between films and projects." And this is as a teenager. And all his movies were working out his demons. But without Steven Spielberg's demons, there is no E.T. There is no Close Encounters. There is no American Tale. And no Schindler's List. And there are so many more. So I guess what I'm saying is this. It's really simple. Go for a walk in a graveyard. Rescue an alien. Slay your demons. And remember, Goonies never die. Thank you.